Welcome to the Acceptable Accuracy Podcast. I'm Philip.
And I'm Tyler.
All right, this is episode number deuce, or number two, for the Wolverine 5K. We've already covered on episode one was the What is the Wolverine 5K? You can go back and listen to that if you choose to give you a little rundown of what we did and everybody's favorite thing, gear, and what we brought. Then we'll do follow up with this one with episode three, which will actually cover the event itself. But today we're going to cover skills with a Z and training that we did to prepare for the Wolverine 5K.
Yep. And 10,000 foot view for those who have not listened to the previous episode, the Wolverine 5K is a tactical adventure race here in Michigan over in Lake City. It's a modified three-gun competition of pistol, carbine, long-distance rifle, and a 5K ruck. That's like the 10,000 foot view of what it is.
That is a 10,000 foot view for sure. This last year we had a canoeing, which we'll cover a little bit today in the skills and training. That is something that was new added as of second time they've done canoeing now. They added it 3 years ago. So I think they're going to be kind of alternating back and forth between having canoeing and not having canoeing.
And not going to lie, when I heard, because since this is my this was my second year doing it, when I heard there was canoeing, I was kind of expecting a 3K canoe and a 2K ruck. So 5K total.
10K at least.
Yep. And Philip said, no, that's not how it works. I'm like, oh, well, that stinks. It's all good. It ended up being like the Wolverine 10K.
Yep. The Wolverine 5K times two, I guess. Right. So we're going to kind of like, introductions always bother me when people go way too depth in instructions, like, hey, to subscribe and click. So we're going to get right into it and start talking about.
So you hear that? Go ahead and subscribe, like, share, follow.
What is this, YouTube?
Why not? That's right. You can't like a podcast, can you?
Yeah, you can follow the podcast, though.
There we go. So go ahead and subscribe or follow or whatever it's called.
And now we did exactly what we said we weren't going to do, but that's okay.
That was Philip. He did not say that to me. All right, let's go and get started.
So I kind of broke this down into three different areas, and they're going to cross paths back and forth. But the first thing we'll kind of start off with is the skills that you need to compete, like a baseline set of skills as a firearms enthusiast that you must be able to do in order to compete. And I would argue, and I would say that this set of skills is required for pretty much any action firearm sport that you're going to compete in. Now, the difference with this one is that you have to be proficient or at least safe in three different sets of skills within firearms, right? And then because there is one thing I'll kind of add before we really get into those specific three items is a lot of this stuff, and the USPSA, for example, we talk about that a lot because it's kind of the standard, or IDPA is the standard everybody goes by. There's a lot of safety things that are built in, the rule sets that are created by an organization, you know, that are designed specifically to make sure that nobody's getting hurt. And within the run and gun community, which I guess this would be part of, or within the, like, some of the outlaw stuff, it's more of what we call big boy rules, mm-hmm. where you have to have a really good understanding of what safety is and follow those safety procedures no matter what all the time. And you are almost, I mean, there's always ROs in the matches, but you are an RO when you're like carrying your weapons from point A to point B. Basic things like don't have a round in your chamber, remove the magazine, depending on the conditions. If you have a chamber flag, great. You know, obviously having your pistol holstered, trying to flag anybody if you can help it. Those kind of big boy sets of rules, right? And there's a lot of like show clear at the end of every stage. But there again, there's a lot of people walking around from point A to point B carrying a lot of gear, right? So it can be hard for ROs to track, especially when there's not like just a generic RO walking around checking people's gear. And that's not just Wolverine 5K. That's pretty much every event that you're going to go to. Any other thoughts on safety, Tyler?
Yeah, for sure. And because I'm very big on safety, every time I'm with somebody new, and they even did this at the 5K as well. We went over the four universals mm-hmm. firearm safety laws, which for those who don't know what they are, they're simply know the condition of your gun and treat it as if it's always loaded. Keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire. never point your muzzle at something you're not willing to kill or destroy, and know your target and what's beyond it. It's such a basic and really common sense safety laws, which I appreciate. And thankfully, anytime there's an ND or AD, it's typically because you're breaking multiples of right. the firearms laws. Yep. So I'm very thankful that they really emphasize that at this competition. And like you said, it's big boy rules. Like it's, they're a little more, I guess, not lenient, but they're more trusting in this, in the sense of they're like, hey, like you guys are big boys. Like, let's make sure we're staying safe. Cause typically this novices aren't really entering this competition.
No,
it's typically, of course, USPSA shooters who've done it for a while. You have veterans, you have police officers, you have people who have trained, hopefully proficiently, with their firearms and their equipment, and now they're getting to have fun with it, but also, well, yeah, have fun and test out their gear.
Yeah,
in a safe way.
And I think the biggest rule of those four, they're all very important, but number one is treating every gun like it's loaded, right? Because you are, like, if you're on a course of fire, you know, you're obviously going to have targets that you hope that were set up in a proper way, so there's a good backstop. There's not, you're going to shoot through it to shoot something else, right? That's on the everybody, but it's, you know, primarily on the ROs to set up properly for the stage, right? But treating every gun like it's loaded, no matter what. Because there are times when you are, like, you're carrying your carbine. So you have to unsling the carbine, put it up against the hill or whatever. Make sure you're doing that into the berm when you put it on the hill, that kind of stuff, right? So really, really important stuff to follow for sure. And I think this match, now, the thought I had in my head that went through while you were talking about the safety rules and about how this is not like a novice match. This is definitely a match. If you're into firearms and you're into competition shooting, this is a match to... pardon the pun, but to shoot for, right? As a set of goal to get to, where you feel like if you're going to shoot a match like this, you have to be proficient in multiple platforms with your firearm. And as we'll kind of get into it, different and unique, like non-traditional shooting positions has to be something you have to be really pretty comfortable in order to shoot this type of match. Anyway, from like a basic skill sets from a firearms, if you're shooting IDPA or USPSA, from a pistol perspective, I would argue that you are probably proficient and ready to start if you've been shooting for USPSA for a couple of years.
I agree with that.
Yep. I think that's a good baseline, or IDPA, any of those sports. Mm-hmm. Three gun, obviously, if you're already shooting three gun, you're probably going to be able to translate almost immediately into all three of these skill 100%. Sets. Carbine's a little bit more difficult because there's not a ton of carbine specific competitions. Now, USPSA and IDPA both allow for PCCs, pistol caliber carbines, to be used in their matches. And I have shot both pistol and pistol caliber carbine in both matches.
So you're a cheater.
I mean, people do refer to PCC as a cheater division, I would refer to it as open, but yeah, open is definitely a cheating division. Anyway, but just knowing your way around a carbine, and I think there's an assumption, and I think in some regards it is, that carbines are easier than pistols, right? They are easier in the sense of multiple points of contact. Yes. They're more likely to be accurate with a rifle than you are going to be with a pistol, but you are dealing with further ranges. But there's a lot of challenges, too, with navigating a carbine within a course, because a pistol is small. You can suck the pistol close into your body, like, you know, bring it in. You can't see me, but I'm like... you know, bringing the pistol, the rear of the pistol, like, to my chest while you're moving, so that it's still in front of you and you're still pointed in the correct direction, but you've sucked it in, you can navigate a lot easier, where with a rifle, you're having to deal with the barrel of the rifle and potentially running into stuff. So definitely some practice around that, and it's something you can practice at your local range if your range allows for dynamic movements while you're shooting.
Or even something as, if you're talking about just moving with your rifle or your pistol, even just clearing your own house.
Yeah.
Because I'm of the belief that, I know some people prefer pistols as a home defense. I know this isn't a home defense episode, but I prefer...
yeah, it's the episode two.
I know, right? I prefer a AR as a home defense gun. And people are like, how do you move around your home with it? I'm like, by putting it over my shoulder. I personally think I can navigate my house just as well with a carbine as I can with a pistol, personally.
Yeah, even if, like, that's actually a great idea, I think, going on, navigating through your house, finding out, like, when you bump into stuff, realizing it's a problem. Obviously, you know, if you have family, you know, do it in the basement while they're all upstairs,
of course,
something like that.
Or do it when no one's home.
Or do it when nobody's home. But no, that's a good example of like ways and skill set you can build within like your outside traditional dry firing.
Yeah.
Just the movement of both pistol and rifle. And one that like both the next skill set that both Tyler and I think a lot of carbine transfers over to long range, but the next skill set is that long range shooting where you have to have the ability to, you know, it's like shooting the carbine, be able to squeeze the trigger and to be able to do it, like in a smooth motion where you're able to be accurate, right? So I think the carbine does translate over to long range, at least in the regard of the functionality of the firearm, typically, yeah. Right? Obviously, bolt action gun, you have to learn how to manipulate the bolt, but that's not overly difficult. But then you get into the technicality of shooting long range.
Yeah. Long range shooting is something that I haven't really dived much into. I mean, technically, I'm still a fairly new shooter. I've done a lot of training in my time, but I've only been shooting for a few years. So I guess 3.5 years now.
Yeah, but I would argue with you, though, there is people that have shot their entire lives.
Of course, yeah.
That are significantly less proficient than yourself, right? So
yeah. And
with the amount of shooting that you do.
Of course. And that's really more for me. I'm just saying because I've dived so far into it. Like I dove straight into pistol and then carbine. And now I'm like, all right, long range is on my list of things I want to learn. So it's really understanding like what is actually on the scope and what do I need to do, because I don't fully understand it because I don't have a long range gun. Right. I don't really practice with that, which is why I'm very thankful because I have three guys on my team who know what they're doing. And one
specifically knows really what they're doing.
So really, which is nice because we did talk about this in the previous episode, how they, since it's a team challenge, he was able to dial it for us. So all I needed to do is make sure I'm on target and I can pull the trigger.
Yep.
So that was very, very helpful for me in this specific challenge. Because last year, I don't know if they allowed it or not, but we had to dial ourselves. And that's really what slowed me down because I just didn't know.
Yeah. I think a lot of it's checking with the RO too. But in general, the RO is if they haven't been told one way or another, their general consensus is that it's a team event, like you said. So like allow them to dial, and that actually takes a lot of the difficulty out of it. And not to say that shooting long distance is easy by any means, but if you have that basic skill set, like I would even argue that shooting a pistol translates over maybe even better than shooting a carbine, because it's a more difficult platform to shoot a pistol, and you have to be very intentional while breaking your shot and not interrupting your sights or your dot or whatever it may be at the point of breaking the shot, which translates a lot to long range as well. But yeah, and then obviously manipulating the firearm itself, you know, to remove the mag, because a lot of times if you're using one long range rifle between the four of people, team members, then you have to be able to, like, you know, back the bolt out, remove the mag, so then the next guy can pop the mag in and then, you know, chamber the next round. And then a lot of it is just trying to figure out, like, finding your target, make sure you're engaging the correct target at distance. And again, it's one of those things where it is really difficult. And I think that if they were to make targets that were small at long range, it'd be a lot more difficult. But typically, for sure, when we shoot it as a team, we're shooting at animal size steel targets.
Exactly. So yeah. They're pretty large. Elk, deer,
yep.
Pigs.
Yeah.
Or the other one.
Caribou.
Caribou. There we go.
Buffalo.
What is a caribou?
It's like a large deer.
So how?
All the hunters are going to be like,
I'm not
actually.
I know. Hey, heads up. I am not a hunter either. So, fun fact.
I have my hunting license. Never been. Okay, so those are kind of the basic set of skills I think that you need to have going into the Wolverine 5K. Again, with long range being maybe a little bit the exception, but having a team member that understands that is really important.
Yep.
And the nice thing is that if they're like less proficient in some of the other items, they can, number one, practice them. But number two, you can kind of pick up the slack. Like, they're not quite as fast, right? As everybody else on the team, it doesn't matter as much. I mean, you're still losing points potentially, but have them go last in a course if it's an order of a fire. But then you're also going to pick up points on the long range section just because they know more about that than the rest of the teammate does. But it is a weird set of skills. I mean, it is all shooting, but they're not all like directly related, right? They all triggers, obviously, but
yeah,
it's not.
The fundamentals are there.
Yep. Yep. So that is kind of where the Wolverine 5K then eventually, or definitely deviates at this point from the rest of a three-gun competition. because the skill sets we talked about a second before, you know, right pistol, rifle, and I guess a shotgun traditionally with a three gun, it's basically doing those things in a traditional three gun in a USPSA course of fire, basically, right? Maybe some longer range stuff, maybe some clays, maybe some moving clays if they have launchers available for like whatever.
And also for us, because it's weird for me to say this, because I guess I would be considered a USPSA shooter now, but for us USPSA shooters, we definitely have more of an advantage in this this competition, at least, because once again, we're going against other USPSA shooters and military and police officers, and of course training is different between the two. So there are times, there's one stage I think of in particular, there's a shoot house where of course military personnel and police officers are gonna go back to their training. So in a shoot house, what are they gonna do?
Go slow.
They're gonna go slow.
Yep.
Slice the pie.
Yep.
Which is exactly what they should be doing if this was a real life situation. I 100% agree.
What's a USPSA shooter gonna do, Tyler?
Gonna game the system, run as fast as you can, and shoot. I still remember my first year doing this.
Yeah.
Philip broke the record. He had the fastest time of the day.
Yeah, and the guy running out of the shoe house goes, he said, I think you got the fastest time for the day. And I was like, oh, that's pretty good. And it was like maybe halfway through the day, right? So yeah. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then we had another teammate that went, he got done, and then Tyler goes.
Yep.
What happened, Tyler?
I smoked yours. I'm kidding. I didn't smoke
smoked it by the magnitude of seconds, which in
it was probably 3 seconds.
No, it was like 5 seconds. And within a stage, though, is pretty good. I think I had like, it was like 41 seconds. I think, I had 46 seconds. You had like 41 seconds.
Something like that, yeah.
So if you take that time, that's a significant improvement. So I held the fastest time for exactly one shooter.
Which is hilarious, because the next year I went quick again and the RO behind me kept saying, you can slow down. And in my brain, I'm like, no, I want to finish this as fast as I can as a USPSA shooter. And when we're done, he looked at me and he's like, are you an idiot? It's par time. I'm like, oh.
I'm trying to remember from 2 years ago, if it was par time for that stage, or if it was as fast as you can go.
I think last year was as fast
as you can go. So I think a lot of times they changed the par time this year, I think, because people were slicing the pie. So
yeah.
And all the gamers, us included, were definitely floating through those stages pretty quick.
Exactly. So, and that, once again, it's remembering that this is a competition. This is more of a game than an actual, like, real life tactical practice or something along those lines.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it too is, and not trying to get too far into the weeds here, but a lot of it is just really, it's one thing to shoot USPSA or any competition underneath the clock, right? Because that induces stress, right? Where you can't really it's hard to create real world scenarios, because you're not going to go out, I mean, short of doing like airsoft or something like that, you're not going to go out and shoot people, right?
You just get some UTMs, man, start shooting each other.
And that is one really great way. But
we can buy UTMs as civilians, though, unfortunately.
Unfortunately for us civvies who are stuck, I mean, there's not a lot of way to induce stress. So USPSA, as soon as you get that, you know, the beep going, you're on the clock, and your stress level goes up and your brain falls out of your head, we always say, and you forget your plan of attack for that stage. But this kind of amps up that, takes that kind of to the next level.
Well, it's like Mike Tyson when he says, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yes, with the timer.
Yeah, I know, right? You don't know until that stress, that fight or flight hits you. It's like, or fawn, I guess, now too.
So I'm actually glad we brought this up, because one thing I was thinking about was...
Get punched in the face?
Fun fact, I was punched in the face once in my lifetime.
Really?
When I was like 8 years old, and I like ran home crying to my mom.
Oh, that's amazing. I've never been punched in the face. Yeah, that's right. You people listening, he's like, man, he's a... Wow, why are we listening to these two guys? Yeah, these wusses.
Yeah, that was when I was 8, so it's okay. So I guess one thing to bring up again with the time is what you mentioned with the time and doing all this under time. This, all of these skill sets that you were going to talk about here, are done under time in one form or another.
Yeah.
So for example, the first skill set on this list is lock picking.
Yes.
So that is a skill set that not a lot of people have. I'm a firm believer that you should have a lock pick set, just in case you do lock yourself out of something that you may not have a key to anymore, like happened to Tyler this week.
Literally a couple days ago, and I was so annoyed with myself, because I have a general idea of how to pick a lock, and I'm like, why don't I have one? Thankfully, we ended up finding the key for what we needed, But I'm like, man. So now I am doing a ton of research of what lockpick set I want to get. So we'll see.
Yep.
Sparrow, please sponsor us. I'm kidding.
Last year, and I think, I don't remember if there's years previous too, but last year they had a stage, and again, we'll get into the stages for the next episode, but there was a stage where you were under the clock, and as part of the par time for the stage where you had to pick a set of handcuffs and then pick a padlock.
Yep.
And I kind of knew going into it that a lot of these skills are like, you need to learn the light version of it.
Because yeah, exactly.
Realistically, to have somebody, and somebody will correct us, you know, in the comments or whatever, but within lockpicking, instead of handcuffs, there are like a set of handcuffs that have basically two locking like type mechanisms that you have to defeat in order to get the lockpick open for the, or the lock open for the handcuffs. These were like really easy to pick.
Yeah.
As long as you know what you're doing, set of handcuffs, right? Well, they have like one mechanism to disable in order to get through it.
That's how the majority of handcuffs are. That's why there's really it's a universal
key.
Yeah. Yep. And they do it on purpose because once again, let's say there's a situation and they're surrounded by
zombies.
Zombies. Well, they're arresting people and they, well, maybe other police officers comes like, well, how do we get this guy out? Like, well, it's a universal key.
Right.
Typically. So we were all handcuffed together to a table, and we had to, they provided bobby pins, and we had to open it up. And
bend the bobby pin yourself. And they told us ahead of time that we were going to know how to do this.
Yep.
So they, which I appreciate.
Which we did practice it, but for the life of me, I couldn't do it. So because we were basically staggered, it was all one big line.
Yep.
We're staggered across from each other on a table. And I gave up. So what I did was I gave up all of my slack and gave it to my other teammate, Brent, and he was finally able to unlock his, because even though we had to unlock the handcuff, what was nice is the first person who could unlock it,
yep,
they could go across the stage and throw an axe. And if he gets a bullseye, he would be able to get a handcuff key,
yep,
and he would come in and unlock everybody else. So this way we could do pistol shooting, and then we could run and open up a
locker.
Locker. So this way we can get our carbines, which were disassembled, and we had to attach in. But once again, for some reason, I could not for the life of me unlock my padlock.
I got you.
But yeah, Philip got me because his was already unlocked anyway.
So actually, I went up. Mine was locked.
I know.
So what they had is they had, again, this is a lot of these.
I'm just annoyed by what happened.
Lockpicking light, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of times they were using the practice locks, like padlocks that are clear.
Yeah.
And you can see the pins in the lock. And they're fairly easy to pick the one that I had. So I got that out pretty quick, shot my targets, and then Tyler was kind of struggling. So I went over with my set of lockpicks because they worked. It was a different lock, but I was able to get his lock open, and he was able to reassemble his rifle and complete the course of fire in time as well.
Yep.
But again, that's part of being, like, they set this up as a team event, right? It's not a bunch of individuals together that run the courses of fire, you know, either at the same time or separately. There's always these team mechanisms where you're helping each other out. And I think that's makes this event unique versus a lot of other run and gun, three gun type events, is because it truly does rely on team. So anyway, we've got a lot of things to cover, and kind of keep moving here and use some of the different scenarios that we talked about. So 3 years ago, they introduced into the 5K. It used to be just a 5K ruck. They introduced canoeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a unique take on the 5K. So it ended up being roughly a 5K of canoe and a 5K of rucking. And that was the same thing this last year as well. So their goal, I believe, is to do every other year of canoeing. But if you didn't grow up canoeing, I mean, it's not hard, but there are some mechanisms within, like, learning how to canoe, especially if you're the driver. So fortunately, the other guys on our team, I had grown up canoeing, and I could probably have piloted the canoe without a problem. But the other guys on the team they canoed all the time. So they were actually able to...
They basically grew up canoeing. They said they lived off the water growing up.
Yep. So they were able to steer the canoes the whole time while we were kind of in the front, and we were, you know, the motor as well.
Yeah.
To kind of move through. But it's one of those random things where, you know, if you grew up in the city, like, now I guess you're going to learn how to canoe, or you're going to end up in the river, which we mentioned last episode. Some people had and lost a bunch of equipment. Anything else to add to canoeing?
No, I mean, it was pretty good, because what had happened was when we're canoeing, and this year when we did it, we didn't have to get out of the canoe, which was nice.
That's
in order to get to the checkpoints.
Yeah.
they're close enough to the water where if you got close, you could take a picture of it, and then you could keep on moving forward. Philip said in years past, they actually had to get out of the canoe and go into land, take a picture, and then get back in the canoe.
Yeah, so, which really slowed things down a lot.
Yeah, makes sense why they did it this way this year to speed it up, because it's a long one-day event, so they want to be efficient with time.
Yeah, they want people to be able to complete the event, right? Exactly. And there's no sense in forcing people to slow down and get out of the canoe, get back in the canoe. And then you have to, in the course, you have to clean your feet off before you, because they're muddy river that they're in, and get that taken care of. So Tyler, how about you talk about a little about backpacking and the things that we did to prepare for the ruck? Because it's rucking with, like we mentioned last episode, it's rucking with recreational is 25 pounds and then on your body total. So that could be whatever you want, however you want to carry it.
Yeah,
and
because my first year, I think you did it with me. We wore plate carriers my first year doing it, because I was like, well, I didn't want to buy both a plate carrier and a nice backpack or a ruck, because
we did recreational the
first year. So I was like, I'm just going to wear my plate carrier, and it helped redistribute the weight anyway, and I'm able to do something in my plate carrier. So that's what I did. And so to prepare for this, one thing that we did was something called Mission 22, which is a nonprofit organization that supports veterans, because on average, 22 veterans take their lives every single day. So we did a fundraiser, and a part of it was a, I believe, 48-mile ruck.
Mm-hmm. In a month.
Yep, in 1 month. So we did that in the month of...
I think it was March,
wasn't it? Yeah, it was March. That's right, because for some reason, I thought it was a good idea for me to do a trip to the UP at the end of February.
Yeah, and you missed out on a ton of miles.
Yep. But I did. I was able to get some, because it was kind of split in half, because I think I did like 10 miles the last day of February.
Yep.
So, which is fine. So, for those who don't know, the UP is Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is basically just Canada. So,
pretty much. Where they say toque in they get their milk in bags.
Yeah, I have no idea. But I don't know. But either way, so that's what we did. And it didn't matter what weight. So for us, it gave us really an excuse or a goal to do this ruck. So this way we actually did it. Because it's funny, because a couple months ago, a bunch of us guys who are all training for the 5K, another team, were all like, hey, let's all do a ruck together.
Yeah.
I got exactly 1 mile.
Really?
I think.
Oh, see, I
and got, I think our goal was what, like 25, 30?
Yes, I'm the one that put the challenge out there, and I think I only made 15 out of the 25. I ended up being sick for a good chunk of that month, and I tried to make up the mileage at the end, but just it was not enough time to get there. But like you said, I think having the stuff you have to do, and everyone wants to do the shooting. The shooting is the fun part.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
But then the backpacking part is really, you kind of force yourself to do it. And if you do have like a goal, you know, or something you're raising money for, or whatever it is, to really kind of force yourselves into that. And I think that really helped, especially because it was a 48 miles in a month. So the other thing is too, is if you're a little older, don't start like with all the weight at once, right? No. Like work your way up to the maximum weight. And we'd agreed that it was a good idea.
Unless you've already trained for that. So
unless you're already trained for that and you're a superhuman person, then just go right for it. And you probably carry 100 pounds on your back.
Yeah, no kidding.
And 45 is, you know, it's a lot of weight, but it's...
Because I think Daryl was doing like 60, 70 pounds at some point. I'm like, dude, you only need 45.
Yeah. But the other thing too is when you are backpacking, and I live in the suburbs, so I was backpacking around the neighborhood. And a lot of the time is at night. So I would have my backpack on and my carrier on. Obviously, sans, you know, magazines with ammo in it. It was literally just my carrier. Mm-hmm. Now, I own a wolf gray carrier, right? So I can put it on over a gray sweatshirt. You can barely tell at night that I'm wearing a carrier, right? Especially in the winter, because you're all bulked up.
Mine's multicam,
but
so
if
good
you're
luck.
Multicam, you're walking through the neighborhood with a multicam.
Which is why I want like a massive patch that says CrossFit. Like, I'm just a CrossFitter, man. I'm kidding, I'm not a CrossFitter. Sorry, CrossFitters, not really. But I'm a powerlifter.
Yeah. Something to take into consideration is if you are rucking with your plate carrier, if you're gonna wear it to the ruck, which I highly recommend. if you don't have a multicam one, may not be a bad idea. They definitely don't carry any weapons with you. I can still carry, obviously, you know, if that's your jam.
Or open carry if you're open carry state.
That's fine too. But
exercise
like,
your rights.
Don't make yourself a target for the police and wear a big old sticker that says Crawfit.
Well, we Crawfit.
I mean, if you're down south, yes, Crawfit.
I don't get a crawdad, but we actually did have a buddy. Did get pulled over by the police, remember?
Yeah.
He was wearing his plate carrier, walking his dog with the backpack, and police pulled him over. He's like, what you doing? He's like, I'm just going for a walk.
Yeah.
Okay.
She told him, he's like, I'm going for a trip to Chicago here pretty soon. I got to wear my plate carrier.
You know, right? Oh, man.
Yeah, fortunately, most states are still, I think it's legal. There's only a couple states out there where you can't own body armor.
There's only one now.
Oh, is it really? California? New York?
No, actually. I don't remember.
Oh, well.
I don't think it's either of those, surprisingly.
But all that to say, work your way up to the weight. Distribute the weight best as you can. Research the concepts behind carrying weight. And the vast majority of the weight should be up as high as possible on your shoulders with the actual backpack sitting on your hips. Would be the hip strap.
Connecticut.
You know, I was actually wondering if it was them.
Yep, it's Connecticut.
Nice. Google for the win.
I know, right?
Okay. One of the other skill sets that we haven't really had to use yet, we'll get into that as to why, but is navigation. If you are running as a recreational team, you are allowed to use a GPS.
Yes.
Electronic GPS. So when we did the years previous, we had a guy that was on our team that was like really into the whole GPS thing. So he was like, I'll do the GPS. We said, cool, you go for it.
Yep.
We'll take down all the other information at the checkpoints while you plot the next GPS point. If you are running hardcore division, which again is the plate carrier division, you are required to do all your orienteering with a compass and a map.
Yep.
So that means tracking your steps, using ranger beads if that's your jam, you know, checking your azimuths and all that good stuff. Fortunately, again, we've got the other two dudes on our team who are really, like, they wanted to really get into this. And this is the area that they wanted to specialize in. Again, division of tasks while you're doing a lot of these things.
Yep.
Those two guys, they did the ranger beads. They figured out how to do it. And we're going to actually go out with them later this year and do it with them. So we have a basic understanding of how to do it. But have two people assigned to that task. You know, you can do more if you want. And then have other people assigned to the other tasks, which we'll get into just a second here. Yeah, it's a whole skill set in and of itself. A lot of, obviously, if you're military, you got trained on that most likely.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then if you were a Boy Scout, you probably got trained on that too. I was a cadet, and cadets did not do orienteering apparently, so I never learned how to do that stuff. But it's definitely something on my list. It's one of those skill sets that just makes sense to learn anyway.
Of course. I mean, crap hits the fan. That's something you'll want slash need.
I'm just going to hide in my basement.
There you go.
With my Pop-Tarts.
I will agree. I'm definitely more of a bug-in type of person versus a bug-out, personally. Yeah. If things are so bad that I need to leave my quote-unquote castle, it's really bad.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the things we talked about is that we talked about
home defense, bugging out, get home. It's like, wait, what's this episode about?
I swear this is not militia training. Please do not arrest us.
Who is the militia?
Well, it's funny because
we are the militia.
The Wolverine, you know, 5K is based on Red Dawn, which is basically like the concept of like, you know, kids having their own like militia and fighting it back against the
Pretty
Russians.
Pretty much.
But we mentioned on the, and again, you're timed on your course. So again, you're doing all these skill sets underneath time, right? It's not short time periods like a course of fire is, but this is a time, this is your overall time for your course. And that's where you set the score and then you remove points based on your outcomes of your, shooting, stages that come up next. But during this ruck, there's also the orienteering part, which is designed to slow you down. And then there is at each station that you have to find within, like in the woods, there's different like intel points, I think they call it. There was like you had to identify like a vehicle, like a Russian vehicle or Russian weapon, like small arms weapon. Again, it's Red Dawn themed. And then you also had Morse code and tap code.
Yep.
that were in there, that were on the list. Now, they gave you, and honestly, this is not overly difficult, not to say a skill set you need to learn in advance. It's good to like go over it so you understand the concepts of how it works. Mm-hmm. But they give you a cheat sheet on how to decode it, and you can also print it off on your own too. There's no, obviously they give it to you, so there's no rule against using it.
Yep.
So the one thing we learned, and we had done in the past, because we had a team that was a little bit older and slower, but this year we were a little bit faster, was if you can decode while you're on the ruck. We didn't do that last year, and that cost us a bunch of time.
And a part of it is because we didn't know. We didn't know for sure if we needed to, when we get back to home base, can we check in then, or do we check in once we're done decoding? We didn't know that for sure. And plus, towards the end, we're all so smoked that we were just truthfully, I couldn't multitask at that point. I was so focused on getting back. I needed to get back to this so I could sit down. Because once again, law of inertia. If I keep moving, I'll move. Once I stop, I'm done.
Yes, I would agree with that. I never took my pack off during the entire ruck because I was like, if it comes off, it's not going back on. Because
there was one area of the ruck, because there was a massive hill that, for me being a weightlifter, I knew my quads were literally about to give out. If I took probably three more steps up that hill, I would have collapsed. Because I just knew, like, I was at that point. Mm-hmm. So then we all took a break. And it was really nice is because they did have like a optional checkpoint at the top of the hill as well. So this
side mission.
Yeah, side mission. Yep. So which was just looking through binoculars and decoding
they had like a some word. Letters. They had a word on the that you had to find, and then you had to figure out what the word was and descramble the word.
I think it said freedom.
I think it did.
Which is kind of funny. Yeah. It's like, we could have figured that out already.
I know. It's fun.
But it was good because it allowed us to not feel bad about taking a break either.
Catch a breath.
Because everybody did.
Yeah, everybody
there were probably, when we got there's probably two or three teams ahead of us and another three or four behind us.
Yeah.
And everyone took a break because it was that exhausting. Which is funny because it was the Daryl Hill, and we have a buddy on our team called Daryl.
Yeah.
So we're like, it's your hill. He's like, be quiet.
Yeah. Please don't name this hill after me. So again, you have all those different decoding you have to do in there. And this year, because of the canoe, the ruck itself was pretty much a ruck back from the canoe drop-off point, right, almost like directly back. And there were a few of the points that were off the road, but you could see the vast majority of them like from the path that we were walking on while you were going through. So it was a little bit faster orienteering, not necessarily required, as long as you kind of knew where you were going and kind of paid attention to the rough direction. You could pick them out pretty easy. And then Tyler, because he was the youngest and he loves us, he would be the one that would just pop into the woods, grab the information, and pop back out while the rest of us were moving up the hill. So, okay, so that's kind of it with Morrison Tap. One other thing is comms. While this is not necessarily a huge thing, there was stages in the past that would require you to communicate over radio from one team member to another for long distance course of fire. It's also good to have comms when you're on the ruck so you can communicate if you get separated. Like if you have some guys that are a little faster than others and they're like, hey, I'm ahead.
Yep.
There's a challenge up here. You know, just be aware, blah, blah, blah.
Or someone loses their radio.
Or somebody loses their radio in the woods. It definitely did not happen 2 years ago. And then another thing that was really...
I'm better.
Yeah. Then this year, we actually used comms. And Tyler, I'm going to let you kind of chat about that real quick, about how we use comms to plan our, like, using our, like, for time management and which stages we were going to shoot.
Yes, not going to lie. You're, like, talking about this. I'm staring at you thinking, what are you talking about? Got it, yes. It's because of how large the range was and because our ruck was pretty much smack dab in the middle of the day of the actual courses of fire, there are times we separated. And for those who are not watching, because you can't because it's a podcast, Philip is opening his candy right now.
Well, that's...
Which is
episode
glorious.
Episode two is that. Would you like some watermelon sour patch?
I would love a watermelon sour patch. Yeah. Because on the episode when we had Brian as our guest, all I did was eat gummy bears the whole time as we're talking. It was
that's true, because we're 5 years old.
Exactly. And I love my candy. I used to be a children's pastor. I mean, I oversee the children's ministry, but still, I love candy. And unfortunately, there's a large amount of candy near my desk. It's dangerous as I chew and eat. You're welcome, people.
ASMR. Comms.
Right. Communication. So, communications, comms. As I swallow my food.
I shouldn't have given it to you.
I
was supposed to be eating while you were talking. No,
I know,
right? Eating at the same time.
Totally.
This is a professional outfit we have here.
Not even close. So, And because of that, we wanted to make sure that we're being efficient with our timing, because 2 years ago when we did this competition, the long distance shooting had such long lines, mm-hmm. and we didn't want to waste our time waiting in line. So we split up and we communicated with each other, trying to figure out, like, hey, which stage should we go to? And we had enough time for maybe two. So mm-hmm. I do remember, I believe it was Brent and I, and we kind of just booked it to the long range area to make sure,
yep.
hey, is there a room? And come to find out, both of them were practically empty.
Yep.
So we called the guys over, got there, and we did both long range shooting stages. The first one was we were shooting just animal silhouettes. Yep. I don't want to get too much into it. And the other one was pretty fun as well. And what was crazy is, you know what? You're going to have to tune into next episode to figure out this one experience of after we shot, right before going into orienteering.
Yeah. I will say, though, in comms as in like a physical medium of using radios, but also as a team communication, which we'll go into some things that you can train on here in a bit. But when you are doing a team event, when you're doing a team event, it's good to come up with a series of both verbal and nonverbal communications while you're there. So, for example, if you're on a course of fire where you're all shooting and you have to be each individual is on a line, and each individual of the four people that are on the team have to complete their shooting, then we would do, for example, everybody put their hand up.
Yep.
I just put my hand up because you can see me on the radio. It's not a radio, it's a podcast. How old am I? Anyway.
I don't know. You tell me.
You'd have to put your 41. Hand up to indicate that you were done. So visually, you could look up and down the line and tell immediately that the rest of the teammates were done, right? And then you would just put your hand up and be like, clear or done or whatever, and then you'd move on to the next spot, so on and so forth. And that actually worked out pretty well. And we practiced that a lot in our training as a team. And I think that saved us a lot of time.
I agree.
And it avoided a lot of confusion, and then it also helps out with safety too. One thing we mentioned earlier a bit was non-traditional shooting positions. And Tyler, why don't you go into a little bit, what does that mean, non-traditional shooting positions?
What doesn't that mean? I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory in my opinion. Non-traditional shooting positions, such as whether you're shooting while lying down, mm-hmm. while prone rather, shooting with different behind cover, shooting different carbine, whether it's your weak hand or your strong hand, urban prone, fetal prone,
shooting off of a barrel,
shooting on a moving vehicle. So there's some of that, of course, that you can train, and there are others that not so much,
unless you own your own land.
Exactly, unless you own your own land, which for us, we shoot at a local outdoor club here in the Southwest Michigan area. But thankfully, our buddies have another buddy who has quite a bit of land that's surrounded by hills and trees, so we have a little more freedom to do something like that. One thing that we have not practiced, actually, is shooting on a moving vehicle, but a part of it is because we don't really have that. We don't have a truck.
Correct. It is difficult because we've had in the past, both years, we've done it now, the two of us, and then I'm trying to remember if I did it in years past, before you and I were on the same team, but we did. You were in the back of a pickup truck with two people shooting from like at one side of the, it was almost a 360 berm. So one side of the berm and then two people shooting the other side of the berm. And then again, with communication with that, figuring out who's doing what. Like this year they had one rifle on either side of the truck and one pistol on either side of the truck shooting. And then you're allowed to shoot only certain targets while you're doing it. So there's some target identification while you're in the back of the truck moving, trying to get a sight behind your optic. One thing we did to kind of test that too was we would be like in chairs, like actually like again at this extra range we talked about that is a little like not the membership range that we're on, but the other one. But we actually sit in chairs and then you'd like shoot in the direction of like outside, facing away from like what would be the bed of the truck or whatever, and shooting targets of that, and actually worked out pretty good. And you can also use that too for like with chair setting up, like to try to get in and out of a vehicle, like put them tight together because you're gonna be tight in a car, put your body armor on and try getting, you know, even do with an unloaded like in your garage at home or something like that, with an unloaded carbine, unloaded mm-hmm. pistol, and load your body armor on and your rifle slung, getting in and out of your vehicle, right? Like is that something you can do? Because it is a lot different, because body armor does add like a thickness to you that you're not necessarily used to while you're in a vehicle, especially if you're a taller guy. It is pretty difficult. There's not a ton of space. Practice going through a vehicle from end to end. Like we had one the first year the two of us did together. I had to go over a console inside of a vehicle that like was very difficult to do. And I'm a bigger, taller guy. So I had to get through the, from one end to another and the chewing my hands up because I didn't have gloves on, that kind of stuff. So those are the kind of things you don't think about, but are worth practicing so you don't get hung up inside of a vehicle. One of the other things too is, I think we talked about shooting on the move. So when you're actually moving yourself forward, you can save a lot of time. If you shoot USPSA and you've gotten to a certain point, you will probably be shooting pistol a lot while you're moving just to save time, because you're moving from one target array to another target array. And while you're doing that, if there's an open target, it makes sense to engage that target while you're on the move. And you can save a lot of time on that. It is a difficult skill set to learn, especially with this match. You have to get all A-zone shots. But if you can do it well, there are some time savings to be had. And that can actually help with practicing shooting out of a vehicle as well, because you get that bobbing, moving. Yeah. Now, obviously, you're controlling the bobbing, moving when you walk, where the vehicle you can't control. But, yeah. Any other thoughts on unique shooting positions, Tyler?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, at least. It's really everything that we just said. The biggest one would be just shooting on the move.
Yep.
A really moving vehicle, because of course when it comes to shooting on the move, there are two different schools of thoughts with that, whether it is very much USPSA, which is like, shoot fast, run fast,
or run up to the spot, stop,
exactly, which is, that's where personally where I land, but I understand like that does take up more time. I understand
slows down your momentum a little bit,
exactly. So but once again, there are two schools of thoughts. If you, for competitions, I get it. You definitely need to be able to shoot while moving. Whereas for me, I'm like, I want to shoot as fast as I can, or as accurate as I can, and run as fast as I can. That's my personal school of thought. But once again, competition-wise, it's learning well. It's good to have both types of skills.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, these are things that you can practice, right? And I think I talked about, and I'm going to beat to death about shooting off of different platforms. But we literally built a VTAC barricade. Google it if you don't know what it is, just to practice unique shooting positions.
Because
even twerk. Even we didn't build it.
Okay, my brother-in-law built
it. We were there. We witnessed it.
Phil bought it. I provided the space and the tools. His brother-in-law actually built it.
That is true.
That's pretty much the way.
We held some boards in place, and that was about it.
Pretty much.
I think maybe we used the drill a couple times. Anyway, so then
it was more your brother-in-law saying, "I think you should try now."
but having something like, even like, because there's a lot of shooting off barrels in this match, especially at long distances, and you can kind of like, they're a stable lure platform, but it's still like a big, like, you know, 50 gun barrel, and it's not gonna, like, unless it's got water in it, it's gonna move a little bit. So getting used to, like, how do you brace up against that, how do you shoot off of that. We had a course of fire where it was long range, where it was kind of you were shooting within like a deer blind, so you weren't truly prone, you weren't truly sitting, you were kind of a mix between the two. So getting comfortable in those awkward shooting positions is pretty important. Realizing, like, how do you, if you're, depending on the optic that you're using, obviously if it's long range, you're using a long range optic, how do you get the proper like shoulder weld while also having, or cheek weld and shoulder weld while getting lined up behind the optic so that you can, you know, properly look down the optic without getting scope shadow. Yep. Same thing applies for a carbine that you're running an LPDO on. All those skill sets that you definitely have to learn. And even if you have a really nice optic there, you're always going to have that scope shadow that you have to deal with. And when you're just shooting on the flat range off a bench, you're not really thinking about it. But when you're dealing with weird shooting positions, or being able to shoot, even like sometimes it's advantageous to shoot an obstacle or course one-handed, so you can wrap your arm around a barricade or like lean over and then, you know, push your arm out and be able to shoot one-handed. That kind of stuff can be useful for sure.
And I guess that's even going back to shooting at like an outdoor range, or a range where you have that liberty to even move around to shoot, draw from your holster. Because most people don't have that liberty, unfortunately. Right. Most people only can shoot at an indoor range or at like a, not a DNR, but basically a state range where you're at like a bay or at your table and you can't move. You can just shoot downrange and every, like, what, 5 minutes, yeah, like, all right, ceasefire. Now you can go downrange, yep, and look at your targets.
Or you're only allowed to shoot, like, 3 shots before you have to stop for, like, 10 yeah, seconds or something goofy like that.
I did get called to that once at a state range.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was someplace outside of Lansing. That's funny. I went with my buddy because he was from Ohio, so we're kind of – it's funny. He said, hey, let's meet in the middle. Let's go to Lansing. And I looked at him like, do you know where – that's not the – okay, that's fine. Not close. That's, like, an hour for me. That's, like, 2.5 for you, but sure. So I did could call it, and the guy was like, man, that's some good shooting. Slow down.
So again, you got to find that space where you can train, whether it's private land or a club that'll let you shoot. Fortunately, the club that we're a member of, they allow you to draw, reholster, because they're all private bays, which is really cool.
Yep.
And obviously doing so in a safe manner, following all the rules that they prescribe at the club so that you are safe as possible. Make sure you're following those and be safe in that. But then obviously work within the rules that you're given. And you can definitely train dry fire at home too. That's one way you can really like practice your draw. That's something I know I need to do a lot more of. Tyler does a crap ton of it, and it has like super fast like draw from appendix. And if you keep at it, you'll, even if you can't draw at a range, you'll have that skill set already built.
That is true. Yeah. Dry fire. I agree. Dry fire, dry fire, dry fire. That's the most important thing that you can do. And it's cheap and it's free. I know it's boring, but that's really the best thing you can do for your training, your practice. Just dry fire. I mean, that's how I got my fast draws. So, of course, you can't do follow-up shots, but get tools for it, whether a dry fire mag or a mantis. Yeah. Or I know, like, the Mantis Blackbeard, like, it resets your trigger for you.
Yeah,
for your AR. Now they can figure that out for their pistols. Oh my goodness!
Do you have one of those dry fire mags though?
I do have a dry fire mag, but it's not my trigger though.
It's close.
It's close.
At least resets it for you.
It resets a dry fire mag.
Oh yeah.
So it's similar, but it's not my trigger, and I know it too. It's funny because I've pulled that trigger so many times. I know, I'm like, that's not my trigger.
It's not trigger. Yeah, that is tough. One of the things we've talked about some of the skills, things to learn, but some of the ways of learning. And training, one thing is there's obviously is a team event. So yep, you want to make sure that you're training as a team, but you can't always be together, especially if you're not like physically within, you know, a drivable distance. You can't always be training together. So there's some things you can definitely train as a team and definitely things you should be training alone as well too. So within that concept and the framework of training like by yourself and alone, if you are going to train as a team, always have a list of things in mind that you've pre-communicated out ahead of time, yep, that you want to work on. So yep, we just trained for this year already, where we went to the long range and we practiced some stuff that we had slowed us down from the previous year. So it was the transitioning from shooter to shooter, moving from point A to point B, and then practicing that and while having somebody else shoot long range during the same similar kind of course of fire. So we worked on that. So those are things you want to have in mind before you do like go to get together as a team, so you're not just shooting the breeze the whole time. As far as all like alone, like what are the concepts? What kind of things do you train for the 5K alone?
I wouldn't say I train specifically for the 5K alone.
Tyler.
But I train
every day.
Well, good for you. I train fundamentals a lot. Whether it's funny because every time Philip and I, we do our best to have a plan before going to a range. This is where we're not wasting time, wasting ammo, and being efficient. But every time I'm basically asked to do a drill, they're all very similar. I pretty much do the same like 5 or 10 drills. I do a lot of reloads. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of target transitions. I do a lot of draws. So my favorite drill is a simple one reload one. I know it's not the most, you're not doing in real life, you're not doing very many reloads. Even in this competition, you're not mm-hmm. really doing that many yep. reloads either. There are some, but there's still a lot of fundamentals there because you're doing sight acquisition, you're doing reloading, you're doing different fine motor skills. You're, yep. And now introducing an AR. My favorite drill of all is a one pistol. Put the pistol away, grab your carbine, fire, reload carbine, fire, put your carbine away, draw your pistol, reload your pistol, fire again. 4 shots, super easy, low ammo, but you are doing a ton of different things yeah. right there.
Yep.
Once again, I like to practice fundamentals, and I find that is probably my favorite fundamental drill.
Yeah, I think the one reload one, the one thing that does really well is it forces you to get that sight picture.
Yes.
Two times in a row, along with, I mean, obviously the reload, because it's that is important to learn how to do quick reloads. But it really helps you force, because you have the sight picture, and then you fire a shot. You break your shot, you break your sight picture, drop the mag, reload a new mag. So usually, obviously you broke your sight picture, and now you have to recreate that sight picture and then fire again.
Exactly.
And making sure that you're, when you do that, you have good control of the firearm, of the pistol, so that you are aimed, and you are getting those accurate shots. Yeah.
And for red dot shooters, it's making sure you have that perfect presentation. Mm-hmm. For us, for Philip and I, we have cheater red dots. I'll admit that.
It is true.
Since we have the Holosun 507C ACSS Vulcan model, which has that massive, large mm-hmm. ring on the outside. So we know when we don't have a perfect presentation. But hey, good tactics is cheating, right?
Yeah, and honestly, I think a lot of that is, I also view that optic as, because it's great carry optic, by the way, if you don't have one, because it's fantastic, because you're all so much stressed if you had to use your firearm, especially if it's obviously most stuff is pretty close up, but let's say there's, God forbid, some kind of mass shooting or whatever, being able to take those long shots with a pistol is very difficult, very unlikely, but be able to
Eli Dickin, bro.
That's true. That is very true. But being able to practice that stuff, and honestly, I think as a trainer, because in your mind, then you pull up the optic, and then if it's off slightly, immediately and you adjust. Yep. So after time, now I could probably pull that out and I would know immediately if I'm off, just based on the presentation of the firearm and adjust. Yep. Obviously, you don't want to be off. You want to get in that right spot, but sometimes you just have a bad draw.
Exactly. And it's life. It happens. And even people who have practiced their draws thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times, will admit there are times their presentation is off once in a while. The problem is I don't want that once in a while to be if I'm ever in a deadly shooting encounter. And once again, this is not a self-defense podcast, but of course we're going to talk about it.
Yes. Yep.
But to go back to what Philip was saying with getting is, you're getting a second sight picture. So now it's another. So kind of going back to that. So Philip, what's your favorite drill to do? What do you like to do on your own?
I like to eat candy.
There you go.
On my own. That's my drill.
Well, he already ate it all.
Oh, so. I already ate all the candy. No, there's a little bit left.
Hey, I'm good.
No, so my favorite thing to kind of the practice alone is kind of...
Spray and pray?
Yes.
360.
Accuracy through volume.
There we go. 363 scope.
Yeah, 360 no scope.
Wow.
360
no scope with a knife across the map, right?
No, I am actually a big fan of practicing movement within your training. Now, you can do this at... obviously, you can take turns doing it as... or by yourself, or you can do it with multiple people. But because I do love shooting USPSA so much, a lot of it is moving from position to position. So inevitably, we'll always, if we get together, a few of us, we always practice. Tyler will come up with some fundamentals drill, and then usually I'll come up with some kind of movement drill or something to kind of create a situation where your shooting is less optimal, whether it's a fabricated barricade that's in the way. So something you have to shoot around or something to shoot between without hitting the barricade. And then for example, and you can create a simple barricade by having just paper targets up. So if you do hit the barricade, it just goes right through. But there are ways to be able to kind of create those scenarios. So those are the things I always like to do. One of the other things you can do as a individual for training is working on the physical fitness related items. Now Tyler does this stuff just by innately anyway, cause he's always lifting, but there are a lot of physical challenges within the Wolverine 5K. Every year I've done it, there's been a tire flip.
Yep.
And then we're not talking your mom's minivan tire. We're talking a tractor tire.
Yeah, like a massive, 200-pound tire probably, at least.
I will have you explain how to do the tire flip just because you can really save your back. But the previous years I would do the tire flip, I did not know what I was doing, and it would really was very difficult to get through it. Well, if you properly learn how to tire flip, and I remember this last year we had a tire flip. And I literally, the different stations we were at doing physical tasks, and I literally yelled over at Tyler, thanks for teaching me how to do a tire flip while I was flipping the tire. If you want to kind of get into how do you flip a tire.
Well, what's really cool is because before I had a home gym and I moved a decent bit away, Philip and I used to work out together at a just local fitness center, and they had a massive tire. It was actually even bigger. It was probably a 300-pound tire at least. It was massive. And that's when Philip's like, hey, the 5K has tire flips. Like, oh, okay, I can teach you. So to do a tire flip, of course, for those who know how to deadlift, you want to get nice and close to the tire, get down, bend at your knees, and hinge your back. Get really close to the tire. Grab it, of course, at the bottom. So this is more of like a sumo deadlift than a conventional, for those who know what that is. So your legs are wider than shoulder width apart. Get your hands more shoulder width down. Get under the tire and really pull it up and push with your legs. And once you get that tire to probably around 45 degrees, now you want to push your leg, one of your legs forward, and basically lean that tire on your knee. So this way it's stationary, it is stable, and you're using 3 points of contact for the tire. So now you're pushing the tire with your two hands and your knee. So this way you're not using your back, you're using your legs, and you're using your whole body. And that'll keep you safe. And of course, most importantly, bracing your core. And for those who don't know how to brace your core, look up Squat University. Awesome, awesome YouTube channel. And he can teach you how to do all of that as well. So that's how you flip a tire.
It's really important to do anyway. But literally, like, I remember I'm not, like, Tyler's a very beefy individual. And I am not by any means a weakling, but I don't do the stuff like Tyler does every day. But honestly, flipping that tire was a breeze. Oh, once you do it properly, it's really not that hard.
Once again, it's all about form. Yep. Form is the most important thing. It's crazy because I've seen videos of these guys that are absolute brutes and they're able to lift these weights that are insane. But for me as a power lifter, I guess previous power lifter would be a better way to say it, is I look at their form like, dude, your form is garbage. But because they're so strong, they're able to do it. In my head, I'm like, if this guy had good form, he'd probably double, if not maybe even triple his numbers. And you'll see like these, go on social media, you see these tiny like 130 pound dudes who are like elite powerlifters who are lifting like 600 pound squat or whatever. It's because once again, it's all about having that proper form and most importantly, bracing your core.
Yeah, and I think even that translates into one of the other skill sets that you can do by yourself, which is backpacking.
Yes.
We talked about that a lot, so I won't beat that dead horse. But honestly, we're in the golden age of information. YouTube has gotten so much out there. You can learn how to properly set up a backpack so that it's properly, again, the weight on your hips, you know, how to get the weight high on your shoulders, you know, and make sure that's distributed again on your hips, make sure the straps adjusted properly.
Yep.
And these are one of the cases where anytime there's a risk of physical injury from not properly carrying, if you're young, you can get away with a lot of this. If you're older, you can having the proper equipment is really important. Having an actual backpacking backpack.
Well, you can't just use a duffel bag with straps.
You can't use a duffel bag. We can if you're 27 years old. But if
I was 26 at the time.
If you're 26 years old, so now he's 27, he's going to go with a proper backpacking backpack. But I mean, honestly, you can get a
Kelty. I just need to be reminded to buy one.
You can get a Kelty backpack that's got everything you need for under $100, especially when they're on clearance for their year-end sale. Like, definitely take a look at that kind of stuff. There's a ton of other brands out there. You can get a Amazon special for that's going to do you just fine for, you know, a couple of years.
We don't support Amazon. I'm kidding. I watch it. I use Amazon all the time, unfortunately.
So that's just, again, that's just one of those other things that you can do by yourself. But then for team stuff, obviously having 4 years of matchbooks available to me, and then I think the matchbooks are still available online, typically at least the last year's matchbook, and you could probably find a previous competitor that has a matchbook. The matchbooks are out there.
Yep.
Use the scenarios from the previous years to train with your team, even if you can't set it up perfectly or if you have to divide that. It's like dry fire, right? Yep. A lot of times you'll practice that initial pull and then you'll put it back in. Pull, put it back in. You know, the presentation before you get the presentation. Then you'll practice from like mid-pull to presentation, mid-pull to and but setting that up so you can practice chunks of that, obviously your range that you're at will depend on what you can and cannot do. But being able to practice that stuff like in advance, because they're inevitably they're always going to have a spin on certain stages where they'll change it slightly, but the rough idea and concept of the stage exists. And then additionally, the match director releases stages in advance. He won't tell you, he'll tell you typically how many targets there are. He won't necessarily tell you how many rounds there are. He won't tell you the par time. A lot of that they determine after the stage is set up, because it's the really hard stages to set up and then determining the par based on what he's able to do it in.
Of course. And even on a practical standpoint, I get it, because it's he's a range owner, and right. he can't shut down his range for a week just to set up. So he unfortunately has to do it the weekend of. So he has to rush at times. I get it. I respect it, because even the members, like, technically they could just say no. Or they could say, like, I'm just not going to go to this range anymore.
Right.
And now he loses money. So it's definitely a hit or miss. I get it.
Yep. So he knows the space that he works within, and then he's able to lay out the rough idea and concept. And sometimes the stages change from what they are on paper. That happens in USPSA all the time, too. Yep. But having those stages released ahead of time, you can actually practice them. And he'll typically release, I would say, the majority of them in advance, right? Sometimes you show up and there's stuff that you haven't seen yet, and you get the matchbook and a car you to run. You just run with it. The shoe house is always the exception. There's never a match plan for that, other than saying go through and engage the targets. And then a lot of times you'll start with carbine, run dry after 20 shots or whatever is, and then engage. And you won't know what's in the shoe house. You have no idea. But, you know, it's a shoe house. It's just basically a blind course. So knowing as you go into it, what you have to do.
Because even as a team, of course, you're doing the shoot house one at a time. You're not going in as a team clearing a room together. So even when one person's done, they can't go back and talk to his teammates. They actually have to stay on the other side of the area, and then they wait until everyone else is done, and then they can start talking to each other about the shoot house itself. Yep. They're very secretive of it, which I understand. I respect that.
Which makes it fun. That's part of the enjoyment of the match, right, is having those challenges. But, yeah, again, just reproducing those in chunks of them, you know, practicing, moving as a team is different than just shooting on your own, right? And we will set stuff up, and we will honestly, like, quote-unquote, dry fire through it. We won't even have any, like, mags or anything in our guns. We'll just walk through it with, like, empty carbines, empty pistols. Run through the whole thing so that we understand the rough movements, who's supposed to be where and who does what. Again, with stages released ahead of time, we always discuss, like, there was a stage last year which had three of us on carbine and one of us on a long-range rifle. So we discussed in advance who was going to do the long-range rifle.
Definitely
not me.
Who
was going to do the carbine shooting. And again, just having that, building that communication skill set. Unfortunately, we all know each other pretty well. So for teams that don't, it can be difficult. You have to really get out there and practice together and kind of understand each other's vibe and make sure that, like, if we're yelling at you to do something, you know, it's because we're trying to help. We're not trying. I would say yelling's the wrong word. Like, if you're in the middle of a stage and you're on the clock and you're like, you know, you have to be able to trust the individuals on your team to communicate to you if you're making a mistake, right?
Yep.
But to do so in a very short clip amount of text, and realizing that they're not trying to hurt your feelings, right? We're not, like, being all fuzzy-dovey here, but you think, hey, you're missing at this location, and understanding that they're not trying to be critical, they're just trying to help you.
Yep. Or even calling for help, like I think last year.
Like the lockpick?
Well, yeah, the lockpick, but I was also thinking of the time when I had the hamstring cramp. So I said, cramp, help, I can't fire. So you took the follow-up shots for me, thankfully. Yep. So we were able to clear that stage because I had a cramp and I could not move.
Yeah, and then again, when you are training with all this stuff, whether it's individual or it's as a team, make sure that you're training in all the equipment that you're going to shoot with all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, just don't take a day off. And honestly, we did some long-range shooting recently, and there's not much advantage of wearing your plate carrier, but it's required for the match.
Yep.
So we were like, hey, we're going to wear our plate carriers while we're doing long-range shooting.
Yep.
And there are things to be learned, because you have, like, for example, on a plate carrier, there's a set of shoulder straps. And depending on where the shoulder straps, how they're stitched into the actual plate carrier itself, it can create more distance between, like, additional padding, basically, between the rifle buttstock and your shoulder. So you have to take that into consideration. Like, what is your buttstock? How is that adjusted? Because depending on your LPVO, again, you may get that scope shadow that we talked about a lot about earlier. So knowing all that stuff in advance is really, really important, and figuring out, like, where the positions are with your armor. And with a lot of this stuff, and I've discovered over the years, I've swapped out gear, is you'll find, like, I had a plate carrier that just did not work with me because the gap that it created on my shoulder was just, it brought the strap off the shoulder and brought it out. So when I would put the rifle buttstock into my shoulder, it would press into that and then pull my armor up slightly. And it would not create a stable position for shooting. So I got rid of that carrier, and I bought a carrier that I did research on that I saw that had the flat straps on it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Any other thoughts about training and equipment, and or any equipment that you may have swapped out, like, over the years, or found that didn't work out for you?
I mean, overall, I'm very thankful for what I've chosen for my equipment. I'm definitely of the opinion of buy once, cry once.
Yep.
So my gear. It's not the most expensive. I would definitely say it's on, like, best bang for your buck. Still,
seen, yeah,
pretty good quality equipment. A very good equipment. That, and also, I was able to luck out on eBay. Mm. My play carrier is eBay. Mm-hmm. My belt, my battle belt, war belt, duty belt, whatever you want to call it, is eBay as well. So I got a significant discount on them, and you couldn't tell that they were used.
Right.
Like, I mean, I was going to use them anyway, so
they bought them to LARP in and never LARPed in.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably what they did. They probably bought it to LARP in. It's like, oh, I spent too much money, so now I got to sell it.
Yes.
And a lot of it was stuff that there's some things that I didn't want in it. So I'm like, all right, I just won't use that part, but I'll use everything else.
Yep.
And it's understanding your gear. Like, with, I guess, for example, shooting while prone, because with the way that my carrier is, mm-hmm. I have my Maximus placard that has two administrative pouches. So it is not significantly, but it is harder to shoot while prone because now I have these two massive pouches that are sticking out around my rib area. So it's a little harder to lie down and shoot. That's fine. That's what I've chosen to use because I have another placard that's more slimline like yours, but I choose not to use it because I enjoy having the extra bit of kits that, truthfully, I don't need. But that's what I'm going to use if crap is fan.
Right.
So, and that's the reason why, like, even for USPSA, like, I want to win. I want to be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I'm thinking I want to be practical as well. I want to find that good middle ground of like, yes, I want to be competitive, but I also want to be practical. Like, okay, this is stuff that I'm planning on using in real life if things ever happen. That's why my carry gun is my duty gun. I use it for everything.
Yeah.
Even USPSA, which is why I'm very thankful for limited optics now. Let's go. I can use my Magwell now.
Life. So a lot of it too is having like, spending is, you know, obviously we tend to both run mid-tier stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like HRT and Feral Concepts is what we run for carriers. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, mid-range items, but they've done such a great job with the equipment that it does. And you can tell those guys, obviously, that created and designed them, were doing like work within that equipment. And it honestly, like after I have my carrier on, like the first time I put it on within like 5 minutes.
Oh,
I don't even realize it's there anymore.
I forget.
Just because we did a lot of backpacking in it. We did a lot of, like, anytime we hit the range in it, we were training as a team, you're wearing it.
That's comfortable.
And it's comfortable. Comfy, honestly. Yeah. Tyler and I run ceramic plates. So we meet I think the 12-pound requirement, I think it was. I'm actually about 14 pounds
easily
with just plates. But we meet the required weight, but it's, you don't really notice it after a while. And it's super, like, and getting that gear comfortable. Investing in the shoulder pads, you know, if you don't have them already, you know, finding out what type of cummerbund works best for you, making sure your equipment's not overly tight.
Yep.
Avoiding chafing and those kind of things. Just kind of figuring out your body, you know, LARP around your house and the equipment a little bit. The other thing I'll say before I kind of end on the, like, training in your equipment thing is you're going to get dirty. And your equipment's not going to look new again.
No.
And embrace that fact. You know, embrace the dings on your rifle and your pistol. Embrace the dirt that's going to inevitably be ground into your plate carrier.
Yep.
Your mags, everything's going to look like super dirty and just, you know.
Yep.
It's there to be used. Embrace it. And I don't know.
Yeah, I'll admit, I might trigger some people right here, but I have purposely thrown my AR on the ground before.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I've ever done that before.
And it's funny because I've done it in front of, and I do it in a safe way, of course, in a safe area. I'm like, I just kind of toss it on the ground. They look at me, he's like, why would you do that to your AR? I'm like, it's my money, bro.
Fair.
It's my equipment. And a part of it is because if my tools can't handle being dinged up a little bit like that, that means I can't trust out my life if something does happen.
Right.
If I have to actually bug out one day and I have to protect myself, I'm like, it's going to be exposed to the elements. Right. So if I can't handle a 1 foot drop, I'd be a little worried. It's like a phone. I mean,
yeah. Speaking of avoiding drops too,
that's my opinion.
Invest in a good sling.
Please.
There's a few things that you should definitely invest in. I think a plate carrier is one of them. A sling is another one. Optic is one that people will typically say as well. It's more important typically than the rifle itself. Obviously, you need a rifle that runs. But the quality control of rifles today is so good.
We're in the golden age of firearms. Yeah, we are in the golden age of
firearms for sure. You know, until we get into shooting lasers.
Yeah, no kidding.
But, you know, invest in those items that are the wear points or the points of failure mm-hmm. that you're going to run into. Like I switched, I was using my Strike Eagle last year for my LPBO, and I switched from my Strike Eagle over to a Trigicon, and it was an investment to get there, and it was significant, and I already bought the Strike Eagle for a previous competition, but
you only had it for like a year, didn't you?
Yeah, but the eye box and the glass clarity at 1X was significantly superior to the Strike Eagle. And then the other thing is I went and switched from like a traditional height canted mount for my scope to one that is a high mount because mm-hmm. of my face geometry. Yep. I'm a little taller, my face is a little bit longer. Just based on my size, my proportional size. And I found that I was able, when I was getting that cheek weld and I was getting the rifle up, that it was more of a red dot traditional height than like a rifle scope height. And I found that that worked out really well for me. That creates a whole set of new problems, but it also fixes a lot of problems that I was running into, like especially this year when you're shooting off the back of the vehicle. I think I only hit 2 or 3 out of like the 8 shots I was supposed to get because I could not properly get a sight alignment behind the scope while I was in the back of the truck moving.
Yeah.
And had I had that maybe a little bit higher, had I had a better quality scope, obviously training will get you there too, but we had actually trained for that, but it was just that way of holding the rifle to my shoulder was like a little bit different than anything I definitely trained for. Yeah. It was just harder. Whereas like when Tyler had the red dot, you were able to smoke the targets because you didn't
have a red dot, didn't I? I keep forgetting. Because once again, this because of the nature of what happened during the time, I chose not to use my AR pistol for that competition that has my LPVO, which is what I pretty much use 99% of the time now. So that's right, I did use a red dot and 3x magnifier for that. Yeah. I completely forgot about that.
And I had an offset on the red dot or on my rifle, and I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the offset. I think what I'll do is a piggyback mount at some point, which is going to press the red dot even no higher. I need to find, and I keep joking that somebody out there, so scope based manufacturers, if you're going to create a high mount, create a way to mount a red dot low underneath the actual optic itself. That'd be pretty sweet.
Kidding.
I don't know how you would do it, but
no idea. So going back to slings, so what sling do you recommend then?
Okay, so I've used personally 2 different slings that have worked out well for me. The Magpul sling is fairly affordable.
Yep.
And I really like that one because it's a little bit more broad than most slings and it's made out of like a really nice, like smooth nylon. Mm-hmm. You can tell they put a lot of thought into it. And then obviously they're a plastics manufacturer, so they did a really good job with the adjustment on the fly.
Yes.
I found that is really quick adjustment to both go in and out on the sling. So you can get nice tight, when you're trying to actually shoot the rifle, and then you can loosen it up when you have to move with the rifle pretty quick, which I really like. And then the Viking Tactics bungee sling, which has been, I still love that sling today. Not quite as nice to adjust, a little bit thinner, but the bungee is really nice because you don't need to adjust it as much because you can really get it tight in there. Use the bungee by pushing the bungee out, and it then pushes back into you to create that nice pocket in your shoulder. Yep. And that really works. So I actually tend to bounce between those two. More recently, I've kind of liked the Magpul one the most. But I know, Tyler, you've got something different than even those two.
Yeah, so I spoke about it very briefly in the previous episode, but I use a Blue Alpha Vickers 2-point sling. It's an adjustable sling as well. I really like how thick it is. So it's really good material. And it's a black sling that has a gray pull tab, so I can easily make it tighter and looser.
That's nice.
And to clarify for those listening, both Philip and I are both 2-point sling guys. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of a 2-point sling. For those who are like, how do you shoot with them? Like, well, when I shoot with a 2-point sling, I actually I fish under it.
And so, I don't.
Yeah, Philip doesn't. Once again, that's the beauty of a bungee sling, especially too. I like to fish out of my sling, so now it's really just hanging on my neck when I'm shooting. When I'm carrying it, that's when I put it back over, and now it's across my neck and my arm. So, which is why I am looking into a bungee sling as well. So this way, I wouldn't need to fish out. I've heard good things about the Warrior Poet sling. I have a buddy who has that sling. I have shot with it. I enjoyed it. It's a little thinner. than the Vickers sling. So it's okay. We'll see. But there are other great sling options out there. Once again, we live in the golden age of firearms. So, and also we live in the golden age of return policies.
That is true. That is very true.
I've bought stuff, and without shame, I'm like, you know what? I don't like it. So I just return it. Yeah, I do it all the time. I did it recently with the belt that I bought. I liked this specific belt but it didn't really work for me for appendix carry. So I'm like, you know, I'm just going to return it. And I did. So, and I'm getting a refund. I love it.
Yeah, so a lot of that is, you know, doing the research. And, like, a lot of time when I bought my first set of equipment, the internet was still very much around, but it was, like, there was less YouTube content out there than there is
today. You are older than Google.
I am older than Google.
So am I, so barely.
Both of us here. Anyway, so kind of, I want to kind of to close this out and kind of round things out here real quick and kind of get your final thoughts here, Tyler, on, like, training, on skill sets and that kind of stuff. It seems like a lot. To the outsider,
mm-hmm.
This is a lot of stuff to learn.
I agree.
There's a lot of stuff to learn. So how do you even get started?
Dry fire. Dry fire. I love what you said earlier about taking bite-sized pieces, even with little things like how to draw a gun.
Yeah.
It's first, really step one is finding that master presentation. Step two is the actual draw. Step three is that presentation. So take bite-sized chunks, because once again, how do you eat an elephant?
Yeah. You put it in a Safeway bag.
Oh my goodness. One bite at a time. So it's true. Take it at bite-sized pieces, do little things at a time, and focus on fundamentals. It's funny, as we're talking earlier, I was thinking, like, why am I so big on fundamentals? I realized it.
Because they're fun.
It's true, it's fun, but when did I get into firearms?
During COVID
in 2020, during the pandemic, when ammo was at sky high prices. I was paying 60 cents a round for 9mm.
Wow. Dang.
Let's think about that.
I was still reloading.
Yeah, lucky. So I was spending a fortune on ammo. So when I told myself, if I'm going to do this, I will go to the range at least once a month. And I did.
Yeah.
But going to the range once a month, that's expensive. So what I did was I just shot one box of 9mm every single time. So just 50 rounds. Not long, 30 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
I just did fundamentals. Yep. I did everything that I could that had enough carryover. And it was an indoor range too.
Yeah.
So there's a video by Lena Michalek that she posted during the pandemic. Like, it was like her 50 round drill or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. It worked out. That's what I did for a long time. And because of that, there's a lot of carryover with my fundamentals. And that's really all I do. So focus on fundamentals. Take it bite-sized pieces at a time. And get training.
Yeah.
Get training. Like, I say that as hypocritically, because I've never actually gotten professional training. Okay, that's a lie. I got professional training for my CPL class because I had to, but I've never actually gone to other than that outside to another.
You can shortcut a lot of this stuff by getting professional training, right? Versus like doing your own training regimen. And I mean, honestly, it's like, a lot of these trainers will produce video content out there on YouTube that you can watch and you can reproduce the stuff that they've done, the drills that they've done, that kind of stuff. It's knowing that stuff exists allows you to train yourself. But there's always going to be somebody that'll point out something you're doing wrong.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's nice because, like, yeah, that's how I learned how to shoot. I learned how to shoot through YouTube. I watched the Jerry Michalek video, how to shoot a handgun, the Honest Outlaw, all of the Warrior Poet YouTube videos. I'm a subscriber to Warrior Poets. I took all of his pistol and rifle classes now online, but it's nice to have a third party person to look at you, look at how you're shooting and say, hey, have you tried adjusting your grip? Have you tried this? And it's like, oh my goodness, I've never thought of that. Like, it's really nice. I love shooting with you because you've pointed out things to me. I love shooting with Brian because him and I have similar fundamentals, but we're so different in the way that we do things that we look at each other like, hey, have you thought of doing this on your reloads, or have you thought about doing this in your sight acquisition? And we're like, no, I never have. And we tried, and I was like, oh, I love that, or I'm glad that works for you.
Yeah, but it does not work for me. Yes,
that's exactly. Okay.
And as much as there is good advice out there, there's a lot of bad advice out there.
Yes, there is. So find a buddy, because most gun guys love to teach other people how to shoot. But make sure that they're actual gun guys and not just FUDs. Gun owners or FUDs.
Yeah.
That's true.
Because
once, like what Philip was saying, like nothing to like boast about myself, but it's true. Like, there are some people who have shot their whole lives, but I'm like, when was the last time you went shooting?
I know. You probably put more rounds downrange than they have in their life, times two.
Probably.
And that's not bragging. No. That's just being intentional. So my closing thoughts are being intentional about this, right? So this type of competition, honestly, there's not a whole lot of competitions that are harder. And if you're looking at like anything that is harder than this, you're looking at a multi-day competition. I know there's a few that exist over in Europe that are really difficult. Yep. There are some U.S. Long-range competitions that are like rucking and backpacking overnight and sleeping out in the cold, and like Mammoth Sniper Challenge, I think of, those are different type of competitions, right? Mainly focused on precision shooting, though I think they've introduced some pistol into that as well too. But there's not, there's not a lot more that you can do that is more difficult than something like this, right? There's just not. So this should always kind of be an end goal. You know, and maybe having like the steps along the way. So, you know, first is obviously getting out the door, being intentional about your shooting, being intentional about your dry fire. Then find a club, join the club, find out what action sports are available to you, or long range shooting, whatever it is that you're into doing. Find a club, find a competition that's doing it. You're gonna suck.
Yep.
And the top tier people are always gonna be really amazing. And you look at them and you're like, what the heck? And you're gonna compare yourself to them. And the first thing that, if they're worth their salt, they're going to say, don't expect to be able to like shoot this fast, but we expect you to be safe. We expect you to, you know, continue to work on it. So continue to work on those skill sets with this, like as a goal in mind and figuring out how to get there. And this is a great episode of the skill sets that you do need to learn to get there. So you could almost use this as a checklist to figure out how you're going to be able to do like Wolverine 5K like competitions.
Yep.
Again, we are specifically talking about the Wolverine 5K today. There are many other run and gun competitions out there where it's truly like a double time or run where you run from position to position. And then shoot, there's also like we'll talk about in a future episode, the Zombie Invitational that is a little bit different where you're carrying a little more weight all the time while you're shooting, but not as much of the physicality stuff. But is more of a three gun, outlaw three gun, but there are traditional three gun competitions. All of this stuff exists out there, and all of it will be able to create like skill set with you and forces you to get outside, which, you know, and get off of screens, which is, what is your dad advice today, Tyler? I know you're not a dad, but like,
yeah,
let's end with dad advice here. I love it. There's a, people have been doing that now on YouTube or podcasts or whatever. They'll end up with dad advice or good advice, pastor advice.
Yeah, no. So I saw a post on social media from Dr. Caroline Leaf or Carolyn Leaf. And this is a really cool thing that I just started. At the time of the recording of this podcast, it's the new year. Mm-hmm. It's January 2nd. And one thing that she challenged her followers to do, myself included, that I am doing, is get a jar and make a note.
It's her jar.
Oh my goodness. is to put a note, a positive note, well, at least once a week, just of one good thing that happened in the weekend. At the end of the year, read through it. And you can remember, hey, this was a good year. Because as Philip knows, to be honest, 2023 was a hard year.
A good year tire.
Huh?
A good year tire?
Yeah, a good year tire, yeah. Because 2023, it wasn't an easy year for me personally. It was actually a very hard year. But being able to look back and read and be like, you know what? It was a good year because it's psychologically, it's really easy for us to look back and think, hey, that sucked. And biologically, it makes sense because for us, we live in a time of comfort. But back then, the reason why we're so, I didn't realize this, but I learned this from Dr. John Deloney. The reason why we're so fixated on bad news or bad events is because back then, when bad things happen, your survival could be on the line.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like going out into the woods. Things are nice and quiet, but the moment you hear that one
the twig snap,
you're thinking like, hey, for us, we're on high alert now. Why? Because it's like it could be something that could kill us or it could be nothing.
Right.
Nine times out of 10, it's nothing. But that one time actually could be a grizzly bear who wants to kill us. So it makes sense. So that's why it's really important to do something positive, to remember and remind ourselves, like, hey, this one good thing happened. This one good thing happened. And it doesn't need to be like a full paragraph. It could be a one sentence, like, hey, I learned this. This one thing happened. And just focusing on the positives of life.
That's fantastic. I'm going to play off that for my dad advice, because I'm a dad, so I can do this. But my dad advice is to be, we kind of talked about it earlier, is to be intentional about things, and to have, and to do hard things, right? And to have those goals for stuff. Like for us, and for me a lot is like, and I know it's for Tyler as well too, but the Wolverine 5K is an event that we do, and it is a once, and we talk a lot about it, and it's a once a year thing. It's a day worth of stuff, so it's only 1/365th of your year, but we spend a lot of time up into it.
Well, what's cool is I think they're considering doing mini Wolverine 5Ks throughout the year now.
That'd be cool. I think I have seen some of that.
I think it's more like a couple stages, like a few times a year.
To practice.
To practice and maybe a couple ruck stuff. But other than that, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
But overall, it's one big event per year.
It is a big event. We do a few other large shooting competitions as well that this stuff translates over into. But there is something to be said about self-improvement that is required to be able to get to this event.
Yep.
Right. And working through those things. And you have saying, I'm going to read 50 books in a year.
Yep.
Right. You can say, and you can do that. There are a lot of people that will truly just say it and they'll do it and they'll get 50 books done in a year or whatever. Right. But there's something to be said about not letting your team down, building that skill, those set of skills in order to be more competitive than you were the year previous, so you can beat your own record from the year previous. But having these type of matches is, it's the end, and then there's the journey between now and then that we try to work on improving ourselves. And honestly, when I get home, there's a lot of physical improvements that I want to make this year, and I'm going to put together like a pull-up bar.
My man.
Because I want to get like points for doing pull-ups this year. Right. And I know that'll help a bunch of other stuff in general, being more physical fitness and get me off of a screen more. So anyway, my advice is find a goal, find something fun that you want to do that would be really cool. Like whatever it is, what you want to do, let's say it is, you know, you want to do the Mammoth Sniper Challenge, figure out what it is. Find the YouTube channels of people that have done it and how they've got there. Follow that path and get there and then do it.
Yep.
Right. Because you'll never regret doing those events.
No, of course not.
Right, unless you like break a leg or something, but
the guy who broke his leg ended up doing it again later.
That
so
is true.
We
that
had
true.
A guy that I know of that broke his leg at the 5K before I went, and he ended up doing it again the next year and the year after. Yep. So,
but anyway, be intentional, set goals, and then be on an improvement to self improvement, and it can be in whatever space you want to do it.
Yep.
All right, let's wrap this thing up. Next time on Acceptable Accuracy. We're actually going to go into the event itself. We're going to try something a little different. We're going to bring in the other two gentlemen here that were on our team and kind of go over the event, over the stages a little bit, the general vibe of the event, get their feelings, their thoughts on everything and how it went. The four of us together is always hilarity ensues, and there will be plenty of smack talking as any good team has. So check that out next time. That'll be the next direct episode after this one, barring any unforeseen consequences or scheduling problems. So we'll cover that. The other thing we ask is to follow us on Instagram under Acceptable Accuracy. We'll post like a photo for the image there, and you can chat with us on there by leaving a comment. And we will do our best to see what's in there and review the comments and respond. Anything else before we go?
That's all I got. See you next week.
See you next week on the Acceptable Accuracy Podcast.